It's Monday, October 18, 2010. The radio program is still on the air. The nation's most listened to sports talk presentation, coast to coast on the Fan Radio Network. Around the world on Sirius Channel 97. And in high definition on Rogers Sportsnet, Bob McCown, Stephen Brunt in our Toronto studios. Wayne Parrish, President and CEO of Canada Basketball. Big uppity up over at the National Post. We'll ask him about both.
He's like... Moonlighting, eh? Which is the moonlighting job? The newspaper job or the basketball job?
This I do not know. You may ask him that question.
As a guy who moonlights, I could probably... We're probably simpatico on that one.
Tremendous experience in that. David Schultz also later. We are hopeful. Oscar De La Hoya and Bernard Hopkins in studio.
They're going to fight?
Tomorrow.
That'd be good. We'll just do it right here. Do the rematch right here.
That'd be good, yeah. And here's Greg Zahn from Sportsnet.
Hello.
Nice lid.
Thank you. I didn't feel like doing my hair yet.
I thought maybe you had some kind of exotic sports car that you were driving around with.
Yeah.
It's very jaunty.
Yeah, I left my driving gloves in the briefcase.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, no, it's a very kind of British, you know,
motoring
car.
A motoring cap.
It's a motoring cap. There you go. Yeah. Keep the wind out of my hair.
So, two games in both series, and I would submit we have learned nothing.
Well, we've learned a few things. The Yankees are a little bit more vulnerable than most people had imagined.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when CeCe pitched the way that he did. I mean, they should be, you know, by rights down to nothing.
Oh, yeah.
And it's it's one of those things. We know Texas isn't intimidated by the Yankee pitching. They've scored, 12 runs in two games, and they don't look like they're going to stop scoring anytime soon.
This is a huge game tonight, you know, for the Yankees. And they got to, you know, they're facing trying to beat Cliff Lee. But if they lose tonight, are they still going to go to Burnett in game four?
I don't know. That's a puzzling decision for me. First of all, I don't understand. You leave him off of the roster in the first round, and then you go and say, okay, we're going to go pitch you in game four. I got nothing against, you know, AJ. Like, I have my suspicions that he's not feeling well because I really thought he turned a corner last year. I don't think he's feeling well because he just didn't have that kind of year. But if I'm managing the ball club, whether it's AJ Burnett or not, I want a guy like CeCe Sabathia to pitch three times in a seven-game series. You have to there to the World Series first. And that's what they pay him all that money for. That's what his history has been. He's a postseason horse. He's the kind of guy that can and does thrive on short rest.
We talked about this last week. We talked extensively about the decision to pencil in or ink in Burnett for game four, and is that a wise decision? And doesn't that come undone if you're in a situation that the New York Yankees could very well face themselves in, and that's down 2-1 going to that fourth game?
It absolutely could happen, and you know, most likely will. I mean, the only thing the Yankees have going for them tonight other than their bats is, you know, Andy's pedigree, Pettit, all-time winningest pitcher in postgame history or postseason history. But they're basically saying, you know, CeCe's not going to pitch game four. Because I have a sneaky suspicion if he had not thrown his bullpen yesterday or they lightened it up, that media scrutiny in New York, something would have been said. There would have been a red flag raised. And yesterday was his bullpen day. And as far as I know, he threw his scheduled bullpen, and that would lead me to believe that he's not going to start game four.
Man.
Under any circumstance.
Under any circumstance.
Just seems like you're painting yourself into an unnecessary corner there, and I'm not sure. They must have thought in terms of Burnett that they had to, you know, prepare him, you know, to lock in for some reason. But you know the guy, Greg. Like, what? You said you don't think he's physically right?
Yeah, I don't think he's physically right. I know that, you know, he's one of those guys that people look to. They talk about potential. They're on and on and on. I'm, you know, raving about his stuff. AJ's stuff is off the charts. When he's right, he's as good as anybody that's pitching in today's game and has ever pitched in this game. And so for me to look at a guy who basically had that breakout season, that turnaround season, and pitched in the postseason the way that everybody thought that AJ Burnett was always going to pitch, for him to regress and go backwards and fall back and have a terrible year by his standards, I would imagine. I just don't think there's full health there.
I think, you know, it's because, you know, everybody who's kind of come out and said, well, you know, he's a flake, that's an issue for him, is kind of conveniently forgotten about last year and the way he pitched in the postseason. You know, this is a guy who did it, you know, with the big spotlight on, and came out with flying colors. So I don't think the notion that he can't handle that situation or, you know, emotionally or something, I think, you know, 12 months later would be seems absurd.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of funny, but you know, I always think about it this way. You know, Nick Swisher is colorful because he's having a good year. If Nick Swisher is not having a good year, are they calling him a flake? AJ Burnett was colorful last year. He was entertaining last year. And you know what? Let's be honest. Nobody cares what you do as long as you play well. And when you come to the ballpark with all of the hype and all the expectations that a guy like AJ Burnett has on him and you don't play well, any kind of behavior that's, so we say, out of the norm is going to be construed as flakiness. But I guarantee you, he goes out there and throws a gem in game four, yeah, and all of a sudden he's colorful again.
You know, the other thing is that every guy who pitches for the Yankees and doesn't succeed, there's the burden of the guys who have flamed out. Everybody's going to, there's the automatic going back to Ed Whitson or something and saying, you know, the guy who couldn't pitch in Yankee Stadium. There are those guys. So, you know, I think to a degree, Burnett, despite what happened last year, that's, you know, he kind of suffers for the history of other people.
Sure.
What happens if A.J. Burnett comes out of the chute in game four, assuming he does pitch in game four, and it looks like he will, and hasn't got it, and it's evident early? You've got to give him an early hook. Who do they go to?
That's a good question. Right now, their bullpen, to me, is a question mark before the seventh inning. I'm not sure what they do. And to be honest with you, it's probably one of those things where they've really, really prepared themselves. I would imagine that Andy Pettit's probably going to pitch very deep into this ball game tonight regardless, because if they are indeed going to start AJ and he's got a short leash, they're going to need a lot of their bullpen to be available, and they're not going to be able to expend a whole lot of guys' arms tonight. And so Andy Pettit's probably going to pitch very, very deep into this game. That's the only answer I have for you. I know it's not the one that you wanted, but I couldn't tell you who they go to. I know it won't be CeCe, because if you're going to bring CeCe into the game, you might as well start him. Absolutely.
Yeah. And have if you need to, if CeCe doesn't have it, then you bring Burnett in the third or fourth inning and let him pitch in middle relief.
Exactly.
You know, to do it backwards doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
No, you're not bringing CeCe into a game in relief.
Jabba Chamberlain?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. But here's the thing.
Jabba Chamberlain is a setup guy now.
He's a setup guy, and he's very well should be. I mean, this is a guy, I've faced him as a setup guy and as a starter. And his stuff is off the charts as a relief pitcher. It was basically the same when he moved into the starting rotation. It wasn't an uncomfortable at bat anymore because the fastball was 3 to 4 miles an hour slower. The slider didn't have quite the bite that it had. I mean, it was almost like facing Mariano when he was a starter. I faced him as a starter in AAA, and you know, his ball had a little bit of cut to it, but as he, you know, matured and learned how to really cultivate that pitch, and he was only throwing 1 to 2 innings at a time, all of a sudden that miles per hour jumped up and the action on that ball got real nasty, and we all know what's transpired since.
So there really is something to be said for a pitcher who goes out as a starter and effectively does pace himself.
I don't like to use that word. It's really not pace. What it is it's command. And the most important thing that a starting pitcher can have is fastball command. And that's one of the reasons why Jabba Chamberlain doesn't do too well as a starting pitcher. When he was in the starting rotation, he didn't have fastball command. He wasn't able to consistently go out there and throw strike one in a good spot and get ahead of guys. And like I said before, the slider didn't have as great a bite, and he couldn't throw it all the time, and he didn't have a good changeup to go with it. The starting pitchers that are legitimate and successful, they're a rare breed, and they're special, and that's why they make so much money, because they have 2 to 3 pitches, in most cases 4, that they can go to. And when you're talking about facing a lineup 2, 3, and sometimes 4 times in a game, you got to have plan A, B, and C, and if not D, if you think you're going to be successful.
So but him coming in as a reliever, how's it different then? Is he's coming in, aside from knowing that, thinking I'm going to be throwing 30 pitches instead of hoping to throw 100 pitches, what is it about his makeup that when he comes in as a reliever allows him to command the strike zone better, or to, does he, you know, cut down, is he throwing 2 pitches instead of 4 pitches, or essentially
he's,
that?
Yeah, he's throwing fastball and slider pretty much. And you know what, he's got one of those sliders when he's right, he can tell you it's coming and you have no chance.
Yeah.
That's his go-to pitch. It's the one that he has the best feel for. I look at him, I put him in the same classification as Amar Maul. You look at Amar Maul with the Cubs, And this guy consistently would throw 2-0, 3-0, 3-1 sliders because it was the pitch that he could throw for a strike, but it was also a plus-plus pitch. And Jabba Chamberlain, in some degrees, uses his fastball like an off-speed pitch. I think he's a slider ball pitcher who uses his fastball in the opposite way that most guys use changeups.
Not to dwell on the A.J. Burnett scenario, but A.J. Burnett 2 years ago signs a big-time deal with the New York Yankees, $60 million, whatever it was, a plus deal. Does that factor in? Is there pressure, do you think, on the organization a year or 2 years later to make sure this guy is pitching in the postseason?
I think that in any other organization, yes.
But not there?
No.
They don't care?
No, I don't think they care. I mean, obviously, we know what happened with Carl Pavano's contract. Mm-hmm. That was a major disappointment for Yankee fans and probably the organization. The guy just wasn't healthy.
Yeah.
And that happens. A.J. Burnett, who knows if he's healthy or not? I have my suspicions. He's one of those guys that you want in your rotation. He's going to be a part of the rotation next year because obviously even if they wanted to trade him, unless they ate most of the contract, nobody would do it. Everybody loves you when you're playing well. And, you know, he's in the biggest media market in the country right now, and everybody's piling on him because he had a tough year. But it will all be forgotten if he goes out there and pitches a great game four. But I don't think in the situation that they're in, the Yankees are the one organization that don't care whether or not he's pitching because of the money. They just want to get the best guy on the mound out there so that they have another chance to win number, what, 28?
If Texas wins tonight, Greg, do you think they can close these guys out? Like, they're getting over hurdles, you know, as this postseason goes on. They backed up against Tampa and then came back and won it in five, finally won a series. They've got the Yankee Stadium hurdle to a degree, although obviously they play there in the regular season, but here they are in the postseason. But they seize a huge advantage if they win this game tonight. And I just wonder if they can put the hammer down or if they're going to play themselves back into a long series.
I think, obviously, there's been enough chatter about playing in Yankee Stadium to really affect everybody that ever plays there. Whether it's real or not, you feel it. You know what's going on. I think tonight's a huge game for them. I think if they win the game tonight and they're up 2-1, yeah, they have a real, real good chance to close them out. But I don't think they're going to sweep in Yankee Stadium. I can't imagine that's going to happen. So, by them winning one of these games in Yankee Stadium, they're going to basically guarantee that they're going to get to go home.
Yeah.
And play. And you know what? They should have won both games at home. They didn't. The bullpen kids were a little bit nervous. Darren Oliver's kind of been all over the place. I think that they know now that they have played so well in the early parts of the series that they can play with the Yankees and that they're in this series and that they have a chance. I remember when I was in Texas in 99 and we went to play them, I knew that we had no chance. Even though we had Juan and Pudge and all those guys, I mean, you just felt it. You knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out a little bit more tonight about both of these two teams. Success, as we discussed earlier, does breed success. And for a team like the New York Yankees, that may not mean very much, but it sure means a hell of a lot for a team like the Texas Rangers, who maybe have swagger, but they don't have anything to back it up yet. They're building that asset base right now. Zonny, nice to see you, as always.
Pleasure.
Come back and see us again. Like the hat, too. Greg Zonn of Sportsnet. When we come back, Wayne Parrish, President, CEO of Basketball Canada. Canada Basketball, one of those two. When Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network, Sirius 97 and Rogers Sportsnet.
Primetime Sports is on the Fan Radio Network, Rogers Sportsnet, and Sirius Channel 97.
Past the hour, McCallum Burns on the radio program on the Fan Radio Network, Sirius 97, Rogers Sportsnet. David Schultz, the Globe and Mail, in a little bit. With the cat dragged in. Here's the president and CEO of Canada Basketball. Basketball Canada? Canada Basketball.
You always ask that. Canada Basketball.
I can never remember because you keep changing it.
This week.
Depends on if you're looking in the mirror or not. He's also some uppity up at the National Post. What's your title over there? director of change?
It's actually Post Media. My wife always gives me a hard time that I'm in charge of the trucks. It's Chief Transformation Officer.
Oh, yes.
No, not transportation, but transformation.
I could use one of those, a transformation officer.
Maureen doesn't quite get that.
We all need to be transformed.
So what keeps you busy now on the basketball side? You have made a decision to retain your head coach?
We made a decision announcement today to retain both our men's head coach and our women's head coach on the senior side. And as critically, we brought in for the first time in forever, I think, we actually added a couple of people. We brought in Michelle O'Keefe as director of basketball operations. Michelle has been executive director of Basketball Ontario for many years and a very respected person in the basketball community.
Good for Michelle. That's great.
Yeah. And we brought in Renato Pasquale as technical director. First time the organization's had a technical director in a donkey's age, as they say. So the combination of those four, we think, is a pretty good combination.
Wayne, is that all that suggests that you guys are on better footing, somewhat better footing than you were when you came into this thing?
See, gradually, yeah. Bit by bit. I mean, there was a confluence of three things in the summertime. One was we did our first major non-basketball sponsorship. Bell came to the table in a very big way. We concluded a team sport funding from Ottawa that we'd worked on for 3 years. And MLSE stepped forward with a new deal as our principal partner and sponsor. And the combination of those gave us what I think of as P&L stability, but we still needed to bring in some people to kind of make this happen. We'd only downsized over 2 years or the last two or three years. And so, yes, it does. It does, Stephen. We've got some stability. We're not out of the woods, but we've got stability.
What is the economic reality of this new environment? What does it allow you to do that you couldn't do before?
I guess the key thing is that when we look forward right now, we've got our junior teams in the World Championship next year. As I sit here right in this moment, for the first time in my 3 years of involvement, we can actually look forward and say the junior girls team, we can plan for 10 days of training camp in Toronto in June, and I know right now that we can pay for it. Every other year, we've had no concept of, and we've gone on a wing and a prayer in terms of hoping to bring in enough money that you can scramble together a 3 or 4 day camp. That's the biggest difference, and it's huge. In terms of planning, it's absolutely huge.
I have read about a significant number of, I think, mostly Toronto-based high school players on their way to various programs in the United States, some already at academies in the United States, high school academies in the United States. But in context, are we on the verge of a little group of kids that are exceptional, extraordinary, will be presumably the core 5 years from now?
We are absolutely on the verge on both the men's and women's side. I sat with Maurizio Gherardini and I sat with George Raveling of Nike International, runs Nike International, in Istanbul 4 or 5 weeks ago. And George Raveling said, our projections are that you will have 5 first-round draft choices in the next 3 years, and that's on the men's side. On the women's side, we have some talent that is exceptional as well. All of that talent is going to develop to the point of being ready to help the senior men's national team. The team that we had in Turkey had 3 young guys, 2 of them who were at Gonzaga, and one of them who played 13, 14 minutes a game and was arguably one of our two or three best players in Turkey. He's 19 years old, and he played more minutes in the World Championship in Turkey against the best guys in the world than he averaged last season at Gonzaga. He'll average more at Gonzaga this year, but he's just going to develop. And the other 4 guys that George Raveling is citing as first-round draft choices are just going to build that further.
Those are the high school kids?
Academy kids? They're guys who've come through that system. Tristan Thompson and Corey Joseph are freshmen at Texas. His dad is Greg. Kyle Wiltshire is a senior, but he at high school in Oregon, but he's going to Kentucky next year, to the famous one and done Kentucky. Mm-hmm. He won't be one and done, but he's got a great shot at being drafted high in the NBA. Kelly Olynyk is one of those 5 guys as well. So the guys who've come through most of the 5, 4 have gone through the U.S. system.
Right.
One has come through the Canadian system.
It's got to be a bit of a challenge, Wayne, and it's that getting people to start looking forward, right? Because there's still, obviously, World Championships on both senior teams this year. The results at the World Championships were not startling, but you're talking about it as a development opportunity. But there's still a tendency, I think, with Canadian basketball, especially on the men's side, to look backwards and say, well, why isn't Steve Nash playing, or whatever happened? What was the Jamal, like, ancient history, right?
Well, and not only ancient history, but I mean, it's funny because our teams, when you make it a year ago this time, we were basking in. Now, it was a small glow because we'd qualified both teams for the World Championship. A year later, you're sitting here, and there's a lot of people that are being critical because our guys went 0-5, our gals went 1-7, and so you think 1-12 at the World Championship. But you know what? The progress that we've made in both sides of the program over the last 2 years is significant, and it's progress that's been made because of those young guys and young gals being integrated into the teams.
Okay, so is this cyclical, circumstantial, that you have a little group, both on the men's and the ladies' side, coming together, or is there something actually going on here?
It's unprecedented, and it's unprecedented in terms of the level of the number of absolutely talented individuals that have got the exposure to be potential NBA first-round choices. They've got the exposure because they've gone to the U.S., quite frankly. We have been producing athletes of this caliber in this country for 20 years, but it's now that they've got the exposure. What we have to do next is we have to be able to train and develop them at younger ages so that they have the skill level so that when they go to the U.S., they get to play, as some of the guys are starting to play now, and then they'll get pro contracts, and they'll move up from there.
Okay, do we need to develop an academy, an athletic academy, like they have? I mean, the one in Vegas, two of the kids from Toronto went to the one in Vegas, maybe three.
Absolutely.
And I can't remember the name of the academy.
It's Finley Prep.
Finley Prep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And basically what they are is they're basketball factories in the environment where you get a high school education at the same time.
We absolutely have to do that. And it's funny, at the press conference we had a couple of hours ago, Michelle O'Keefe was asked what her role with the organization would be. And her first thing was to talk about basketball schools. We have been working with Ontario Basketball, which Michelle has led up until this over the last 3.5 years, on a survey that looks at why kids go to the U.S., what they get here, et cetera, et cetera. We've just finalized the results. We're going to build basketball schools in this country, God willing and budgets willing, that are going to give kids alternatives. Not that some of them shouldn't still go to Finley Prep and go to schools in the States. The problem is that not as many should go as are going currently. We're going to build alternatives. We need to build alternatives in this country to keep them here. And then we need to build a professional league in this country that will keep them here, that will give them a place to play after university in that 22, 23, 24, 25 age group.
We all going to live long enough for that, Wayne?
I think we are, Stephen. I mean, strangely,
I feel good right now. But,
two years ago, I would have said absolutely not. 1 year ago, I would have said, geez, I don't know. But we've been working on that project for a couple of years now, and I really do think, just from some of the people that we've been talking to and meeting with and so on, even over the past month, I think we have an opportunity, we have a chance to get there.
Are the 2011 Worlds the Olympic qualifying next?
The 2011 FIBA Americas Championship is the Olympic qualifying.
How, in terms of the grand plan here, how important is it for you guys to get to London on both sides?
You know what? It would be a lovely thing to do, but as I'm sitting here, Stephen, right now, I'm not suggesting that we're going to qualify for London on either gender. I mean, I think we've got a slightly better chance on the women's side. It's a long shot on both. There's only 12 teams in the Olympics. There's 24 in the Worlds. Where we are really aiming for is 2014, 2016. By that time, these young athletes will have developed and matured to the point where they can compete with the best in the world, senior guys who are going to knock them down, gals are going to knock them down and knock them over and so on. And by that time, they're going to be ready to compete. We have a shot. We have an outside shot. A whole bunch of things have to happen really well.
Talked about 14 and 16. And stuck in the middle, interestingly enough, is 15, which would be the Pan Am Games here in Southern Ontario.
Yes, indeed.
And basketball traditionally has been one of the big draws, if not the biggest draw, at the Pan Am Games.
We think, and I, when I say we, I mean Canada Basketball, myself, but Toronto 2015 and Ian Troop, who runs the show there, we together think that we can make basketball bigger at these Pan American Games than it has ever been. We think we can make it into what hockey was to the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. Now, we got to do some things to get there, but we are working on an approach that we think can accomplish that by 2015.
Does it matter what kind of team the U.S. sends?
Absolutely it does. So we have to figure out the right way to attract the very best American players here for that event.
So you want, the year before the Olympics, you want their Olympic team if you can get it.
We absolutely do. Or we want the second best, which would be the Kevin Durants and the Russell Westbrooks of 2015.
Yeah.
One or the other. And it may be that the latter is the more preferable one, but that's what we want.
But the way that becomes what you're suggesting, Wayne, is that you have that team and a Canadian team that would be competitive with it.
Yes, absolutely so.
And do you think there's a greater chance of luring that team because we're in the North American continent, we're in the Eastern time zone, blah, blah, blah?
I think there would be a better chance if we could find a way to integrate the Olympic qualification tournament for 2016, both men and women, with the Pan American Games.
Is that doable? Is that a FIBA? How's FIBA going to feel about
It's been tried many times over 25 years and never got close to the finish line. But between Maurizio and I, we're foolish enough that we think that it is doable.
Talk to Brian Colangelo's daddy about this stuff?
We have spent a lot of time with Brian Colangelo's daddy on this
stuff. And where is he?
He is very supportive. Very supportive. We had Maurizio and I had a lovely lunch with Jerry and Jim Tooley, who is my equivalent at USA Basketball in Istanbul again about 4 weeks ago, and tremendously supportive.
Well, congratulations on a job well done over the last little while, and there is great anticipation about the immediate future of this program over the next 3 to 6 years, I guess.
Yeah.
We will see how things develop.
We shall indeed. Thanks.
Nice to see you, Mr. Parrish, as always.
And you as well, Mr. McCann and Mr. Brunt.
Wayne Parrish, President and CEO of Canada Basketball. David Schultz of the Globe and Mail, coming up when Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network, Sirius 97 and Roger Sportsnet.
Primetime Sports is on the Fan Radio Network, Rogers Sportsnet, and Sirius Channel 97.
Eighteen minutes before the hour. It's the disease that won't go away. It's the cold that lingers forever. It's like marriage. It's the Phoenix Coyotes. And I'm hesitant to say anything definitive, like there may be, even maybe a deal. Is that's too definitive even for this?
I think definitive is, it would be wise not to go the definitive route on this story. Actually, the lessons of the last several years have been that.
How about this? There's another guy.
There's a guy.
There's a guy, and he might be, and we don't know if he is. But David Schultz continues to cover this story, much to his regret, I'm sure. Here's Schultz. Hello.
Much to my extreme regret.
Oh, come on.
I've never seen a story with so many liars. And even the guys who tell the truth don't usually tell the whole truth. So, but it amazes me that this time around, so many people, and I mean more than the usual idiot Coyote fans who populate Twitter and comment sites on newspapers, in other words, all seem to think this is a done deal. Just, you know, despite the fact so many other deals have fallen apart after announcements have been made and all this, it just boggles the mind.
So the guy's name, the proposed buyer's name is Matthew Hulsizer, but here's some of the things that are concerning to me, and I assume to you. Mr. Hulsizer will share the equity with, wait for it, Ice Edge.
He better make sure the check is certified. That's all I can say.
And it's alleged that Ice Edge would take 30% equity in the franchise. Is that what you've heard?
Yes. I wrote that too, except I believe it got trimmed out of my story for space reasons.
What would the cost of that 30% in equity in the franchise be, David?
You know, it's funny. I was trying to do the math in my head the other day, and I've been told Hulsizer's willing to pay $140 million. Why he's willing to pay that much, I have no idea, since the last real price we know of a team was the $100 million cash that Jeff Vinnick paid for the Tampa Bay Lightning, which is certainly a franchise that's in far better shape and has a much busier arena contract to go with it. So 30% of $140 million, which would be 30 and
change
another 12, so $42 million. My belief is that the Ice Edge guys had at most $20 million in cash. So presumably there is somebody out there crazy enough to lend them another $22 million.
And to become a minority partner in this enterprise, which
yeah,
would...
Yeah, well, now we'll see. I mean, they've done a lot of hooting and hollering about what great marketers they can be with a team. I don't know how busy Matthew Holzhizer is, whether he wants to take an active part in this or not, or let these Ice Edge characters go to town. I don't know. But the thing that kills me is that this is far from a done deal. I mean, Reinsdorf's been this far at least, twice with these guys, with the city. And so and Ice Edge was there, too. So why people should think this is going to be any different until everything is signed, sealed, and delivered is beyond me. And this goes without even mentioning the Goldwater Institute.
Yeah, where are first of all, Schultz, before we get to them, in theory, how deep are the people of Glendale into this now? Because they also, in addition to that subsidy deal, they're going to have to top up the price, right?
Yeah. They had already, I guess it's not that much of a surprise that they agreed to top up the price, you know, fill in what Holzhizer didn't want to pay, which I'm told is $25 billion. But they've basically agreed to subsidize losses through this community facilities district. And if you look at the Reinsdorf deal, that deal called for them to pay off the top $25 million a year to the NHL for the first 3 years of the deal as part of the purchase price. So that was $65 million. So presumably the same thing's going to happen here, only it's going to be $25 million. But in addition to that, they were committing for well over $10 million a year to cover the losses through parking, through these levies, property levies, sales taxes in this community facilities district around the arena, which is basically Westgate City Center, which is owned by Steve Ellman, the guy who
started this thing,
this whole mess, and then got out because he couldn't pay the bills. So I'm sure, and these levies are voluntary, as I recall, so he too has probably come to some sort of sweetheart deal with the city of Glendale to allow these levies.
But Dave, if those levies,
cash,
how can they generate enough money to cover this?
How do they raise the cash? Because in all of last year, in their whole sports district, they raised exactly $13 million in sales tax. So only part of that sales tax can go to this. And the fine print, at least in the Reinsdorf deal, and I think in the Ice Edge deal, said if there's any shortfall, good old Glendale's on the hook for it.
There's 250,000 people in Glendale, correct?
Yes. So and at this point, the Arizona Republic did an interesting story a week or two ago that pointed out, if you look at all of the sports deals Glendale has done from the Jobing.com arena where the Coyotes play to the spring training thing they erected for Jerry Reinsdorf's team to this proposed deal with USA Basketball, which has fallen through, they are on the, and they don't, I don't believe they included the football stadium because it pays for itself, as most NFL properties do. They are on the hook for a total of $500 million.
Have they suspended democracy?
$250,000.
Have they suspended democracy there? Like, I don't understand why people are not storming the city hall with pitchforks and torches.
They must have the dumbest, most docile taxpayers on the continent. I mean, that worked out. The Arizona Republic pointed out that works out to a little over $3,000 per person. Now, as I was telling a friend of mine, I was talking about this story today, I said, you know, per capita, that, you know, I probably owe a lot more money than that, you know, my household debt. But the difference is I have a job that money's coming in, and I'm thankfully have enough seniority that I'm not likely to get fired tomorrow. Glendale's problem is they don't really have the equivalent of a full-time paying job to pay these bills. When you look at what they're looking at to get revenue out of this facilities district, they got the equivalent of a teenager flipping burgers at McDonald's, and maybe not even that. And so there is going to be a down the road, it may be 2 years, it may be 3 years, there is going to be a day of reckoning for these poor people. And, you know, I just, it's going to be awful. But I'm sure the politicians who got them all, and I was told Elaine Scruggs, the mayor, is not going to be running for re-election again, so I guess she doesn't have to worry about it.
How about the old guy that was moved to tears by the kid in the Coyotes jersey? How's he doing?
Well, you know, he's good every once in a while. He'll get up on his hind legs and say, this is crazy, you know, we're nuts. But when push comes to shove, he's there. And as far as I know, he still is. It just makes you stand back and marvel. But, I mean, hey, if this deal goes through, and right now, who says it can't? I tell the people in Winnipeg, don't worry. They are just postponing the inevitable because there is still no evidence that even that wondrous season the Coyotes had last year has translated into full houses. Okay, sure, yeah, I hear they sold out their home opener the other night, but, you know, most teams do that. But I don't think they have tripled their season ticket base. I don't think they've sold out every suite. I'd be surprised if they're making any significant money from their broadcast contracts. So, you know, it just, you know, they're going to stagger on for another year or so, and until somebody cries uncle from paying all the losses, whether that's Hulsizer, whether that's Glendale. I mean, the way the NHL guys explain it is, well, you know, all they're really going to do is subsidize big losses for the next 2 or 3 years because Jerry Moyes and Jim Balsillie ruined the franchise. Well,
right.
You know, hey, that franchise was struggling long before Jim Balsillie showed up.
No, it was ruined before Balsillie showed up.
It was ruined when Elman decided to build an arena way out
in the middle of
West
nowhere.
Valley on the opposite side of any hockey fan with money in his pants. So,
what do you think the chances are? We only have about a minute. What do you think the chances really are that if this thing with Hulsizer does not materialize, and I'd say it's, you know, no better than 50-50 right now, maybe a lot less than that. I mean, is Winnipeg the obvious destination? I mean, you just mentioned Winnipeg in passing, and I don't want to mislead people into thinking that if it doesn't work in Phoenix and the NHL picks this franchise up at the end of the year, that Winnipeg is the only place it can go.
No, probably not. I mean, they do have some sort of nod-to-wink deal with Winnipeg. So at this point, yeah, you'd have to say if things don't work out, whether it's next year, the year after, whenever, that Winnipeg is the obvious choice. But, you know, the thing I've learned with this story is you can't rule anything out.
That's right.
Some guy may come along. I'm sure they don't have anything in writing with Winnipeg, and that you do that at your peril, anything connected with the Coyotes. And so if some guy comes along and says, I'll give you $180 million if you let me move it to Kansas City, Houston, you know, pick a city.
There's a deal.
You know, yeah, yep. It's like, hey, Winnipeg.
Sorry, you lose.
Like, trust me, there's 24 American governors and probably six Canadian governors who would rather not go to Winnipeg.
Yeah. David, I hate to cut you, but we got to get out of here. Thanks, pal. We'll talk to you soon. The never-ending story of the Phoenix Coyotes marches on. And while Mr. Hulsizer, I'm sure, has he's supposedly got more money than Jerry Reinsdorf, I'm told. So
that's what somebody said that, yes.
Yeah, well, he's got the do-re-mi, I guess, to do this deal. But the minute you hear that he's prepared to give 30% of the equity to the Ice Edge guys, suddenly I get the feeling that this is another tease for the city of Glendale, a deal that can't get done. Our thanks to David Schultz and to Wayne Parrish for joining us, to Greg Zahn as well. You going to come back tomorrow now?
I'm planning on it, yes.
Well, do your best. For Stephen Brunt, Bob McCown, see you tomorrow night on Primetime.